This is what you hear when the President of the United States appears at any official event. It's part of the pomp and ritual surrounding not just the position itself, but also its public image. As we gear up for another presidential election, we hear a lot of talk about how presidential each candidate seems, how well each one matches our idea of what it means to be President of the United States. But where did that idea come from in the first place, and can it change? Has it changed? I'm Gina Kaufman, and who better to offer insights than the editor of a book series all about the presidency, Chuck Myers, director of University Press of Kansas. Welcome to KCUR's Central Standard. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
Not only do you publish books on the presidency at the University Press of Kansas, but you were previously the political science editor for Princeton University Press, where you published books on the presidency as well. After years of studying one person after another in the highest office, what do you think are some of the subtleties of the role that most of the electorate either doesn't get or doesn't appreciate like you do?
I think part of the role of the president that people don't appreciate is how much the president has to balance the political conditions in which they operate. The presidency seems like an extremely powerful office, and in many ways it is. But in many ways, the president is hamstrung by the separation of powers, by the conditions that particularly international conditions that they cannot control.
I mean, the whole idea of the American political system is that no one person can just waltz in and have their way.
That's right.
Well, but you said, this is interesting, that the president, the position seems more powerful than it is. Is that partly because of some of the trappings of how we present what it is to be presidential? I mean, even just hearing that music.
I think that the presidency is a combination of political leader and, in a sense, a tribal chief. So the presidency, in many respects, the president has to project an appearance of competence and control, when in reality, there's often very little they can control. Harry Truman was quoted as saying that President Eisenhower would find the office very frustrating because he would order something to be done, as he had in the military, and find out that nothing happened after he'd issued the order because of the complexity of the bureaucracy and the relations with Congress and the number of conditions they cannot control.
You also publish books about first ladies. How do first ladies fit into this bigger idea of what it means to be president and what it means to be presidential?
One of the ways that I think first ladies fit into this is goes to the kind of softer characteristics that are involved in being presidential. The being presidential is a projection of competence, honesty, moral probity, and first ladies contribute to that by the kinds of activities they engage in, the way they support the presidency, the kind of family life they run. And so they're part, in a sense, of the PR operation of the White House.
Can you give like two contrasting first lady examples in terms of how they contributed to differing perceptions of their husbands, of the presidents?
Well, for example, I think Nancy Reagan, who just passed away, projected an image of being supportive of her husband, of being focused on domestic issues, of not trying to upstage her her husband in the office, whereas this is becoming more of an issue as women develop careers of their own. Somebody like Hillary Clinton seemed to seek a role in policymaking in the White House and became involved in the abortive effort to create a national health plan in the early Clinton administration. And this was controversial because she was perceived as not being elected to an office. So the contrast, and this played into Mrs. Bush, Laura Bush, retreated to a much more domestic role as first lady.
When you hear the music we just played, Hail the Chief, do any words or images come to mind that you think capture both the music itself and the office of the presidency?
Well, I think to me, when I hear that, I think of the president as a leader of the military, actually, and international affairs, because one of the primary roles of the president is how they interact with other foreign leaders and how they exercise American power abroad. One of the things that's been observed about the presidency is that especially second-term presidents tend to focus on international issues because they actually have more latitude in that area than they do in domestic politics. And I think when I hear that music, I see the president meeting with a foreign leader with all the pomp and ceremony at the White House or when they're on a state visit abroad.
For me, I hear like power and sure-footedness. The cymbals are big and loud, mm-hmm. and the rhythm is so even and steady. I mean, you could replace your clock and measure time with this song, and you would not miss a beat. Are those characteristics that it's important for people who are angling to become president to project? Power, sure-footedness, steadiness?
Yes, I think that those are all characteristics that Americans expect in their president. They want to see the president as competent, as emotionally stable, as knowledgeable, and is in command of any given situation. And you're right, that song projects those kinds of values. At the same time, Americans like to see their president as the guy or woman next door, the guy who they would like to have a beer with, as was said of George W. Bush.
Yeah, I definitely want to get back to that idea. When we think about the song, just one more question
Sure.
about that. I mean, are we hearing how the president is supposed to be or how we are supposed to feel in his presence? I say his because so far that has been the gender pronoun for U.S. presidents, something we can obviously explore at some point in this conversation. But it seems to me that part of this is telling us how to feel when the president is speaking, when the president is appearing.
Yes, I think projects a notion that we are to be in the space with someone who we respect, who we honor, and who represents America in some sense.
Historically, when do we first see the idea of someone not just being presidential in the sense of being president, but being presidential in character, the sense of possessing and exuding certain character traits?
I think this goes back to the beginning of the presidency. George Washington created a presidency out of whole cloth. There was no precedent in the world for this office. And one reason he was chosen is that he had established a reputation for being above partisan. At that time, there weren't parties, but above the kinds of splits that were happening in the United States, and had the respect. He was seen as an honest man whose life was dedicated to the United States.
How did he shape that idea of himself? I mean, was it deliberate, like kind of the way we would think of today of branding?
I think George Washington was very conscious of his place in the world, of the fact that he was creating this office. He was very aware of his image. It went down to things like how he dressed, how he was addressed. Do you call him Your Highness, Your Excellency? How Mrs. Washington appeared to people. So it's creating the job of First Lady. He was very much aware of the image he projected.
What were those decisions he made? I mean, you talk about his decisions about how to dress, how to be addressed, how his wife appeared.
He did not choose to be addressed as His Highness. He had to figure out how he was going to appear before Congress, whether he would go to Congress or not. He tried a few times and then pulled back from that. He was very conscious of his dignity. I don't think you would go up to George Washington and offer him a beer. but
so he didn't want to be the guy next door.
No, he did not want to be the guy next door, but he also did not want to be a king. And I think it's very important that he reluctantly was elected to a second term, but did not choose to serve beyond that and established what became the norm until Franklin D. Roosevelt of two-term presidents. He did not want to be a monarch.
So how have the trappings of the presidency transformed since George Washington kind of established them? I mean, starting with John Adams.
Well, I mean, John Adams tended to have a bit more formal sense of the presidency in some way. So he, in a way, he continued much of what Washington had, but he did not have Washington's prestige. And also by the time Adams came along, there were parties had developed. And so he was seen as a leader of a particular faction. And that made it more difficult for the president to appear to rise above this kind of bickering. So the trappings of the office developed in part to reflect the personalities of the people and in part to reflect the kind of image they wanted to project. Thomas Jefferson wanted to project a much simpler image.
How did he do that?
Well, he walked, I believe he walked to his inauguration. He tended not to have the kind of formal entertainments that the Washingtons had had. He did not go to Congress to deliver his addresses. He at the same time, he actually built the power of the presidency in many respects. The Louisiana Purchase was a presidential initiative without congressional approval. So he acted as a powerful president, but he wanted to make it a simpler office.
So do you think that the simplicity he was trying to give off in some ways was to counterbalance the power he was assuming?
I think that could be. He was somewhat conflicted about what the power of the national government, the federal government, should be. So on one hand, he did exercise it in particular instances, but on another hand, a lot of what he and his partisan group were advocating was a less powerful government, a government that did not have a national economic policy, for example.
What about Andrew Jackson? I'm not going to take us through every single president, don't worry, but these early characters really established, I'm guessing, so many of the ideas that we take for granted today.
Right. Well, Andrew Jackson came in office succeeding John Quincy Adams, who was a much more formal sort of president, and he wanted to project the image of the president as one of the people. So he very famously at his inauguration opened the White House to everybody, and it was a party to end all parties in a way at the White House. And he was leader of the Democrats. He wanted to project an image of the government as a government of the people, and that means, but he also was a very strong character. I mean, he was very decisive in his actions and fought with Congress quite a bit. So you had this kind of interesting interplay between somebody who wanted to be seen as one of the sort of a regular guy, at the same time was a very strong leader.
How did he go about communicating to the American people the side of himself that was the regular guy?
Well, I think it was by things like opening the White House and being open to people coming in. I mean, there was, in those days, there was much more, the White House was a much more open place, and people would come in, supplicants for jobs and people who had complaints and felt that they had the right to see the president. So, and this was also a time before great mass media, so it was, you didn't have quite the same ways of projecting that image, but there was a sense, to the extent he took advantage of the news media of the day, to show that he would meet with anybody.
Could we fast forward to just think about, beyond Andrew Jackson, who are some of the key figures who have really transformed in some way or complicated our idea of what the word presidential can and should include?
Well, for one thing, in many of the candidates, if you think of the presidents up to Lincoln and onward, there was always this contrast. They would often run political campaigns as sort of from the log cabin. You know, they were Abe the rail splitter. They tried to project an image that they came from humble roots.
Why?
Because I think they wanted to show people that they understood their problems, that they had the interests of the common man, who was really in some ways at the center of American politics.
Were people still anxious about the idea of royalty, and just because this seems also like a strong contrast with like a royal family?
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's very important that one of the prevailing stories in American life is that anyone can become president, that you can rise from humble beginnings and become president of the United States.
So it's a story we like to retell again and again. That's a story we like to retell,
yes,
about every 4 years.
We do. I mean, I remember during the first Obama presidential campaign meeting a woman whose child was she and her child were African American, and she said to me. She said to her child, "You see, you can become president of the United States. There's a black man running," and that, you know, that's a prevailing theme throughout American politics.
Yeah, I mean, looking not just at Obama, but you know, JFK in 1960, first Roman Catholic president. How does a moment like that? Does a moment like that truly expand our idea of what it means to be presidential, or does a moment like that turn out to be an anomaly?
I think moments like that expand the idea of who can become president. That religious belief, race, and now gender do not preclude anybody from becoming presidential, or becoming president, and therefore having the qualities that we think of as being presidential. We're seeing that now with Mrs. Clinton. The question of can a woman be presidential? Can a woman project the confidence and strength and knowledge that we expect of a president?
Is that just what we expect, or are part of our expectations related to what we think the rest of the world expects? I mean, thinking about something like gender, I'm curious, when we talk about who is presidential, are we talking about just what the electorate views as presidential, or what the world views as presidential?
That's an interesting. I think they're tied up. I think voters sometimes think about how the president will deal with foreign crises. So that often when, for example, they talk about an October surprise before the presidential election. If there's a big international conflict, will people think that a Democrat or a Republican is better equipped to handle that crisis? If we have a male and a female running for president, which gender might be more capable of responding to an international crisis? So I think voters, to some extent, consider that. And certainly with Mr. Trump, there's some critics of his candidacy who say that he will not project a positive image abroad, witness the British effort to ban him from the country. So I think voters think about those things.
How much of a president's role really is kind of representing the country?
It is, I think, a significant part of the role because our president combines the head of government with the head of state in one office. That's one of the reasons that it's such a difficult job. And
How is that different from other models?
Well, for example, in Britain, where you have a queen, the queen is the one who goes and makes formal visits to other countries and represents Britain in a way that the prime minister does not. When the queen comes to Washington, there'll be a state dinner. I do not believe the prime minister is generally accorded a state dinner.
So the queen can be the gracious guest who gets along with everyone, while the prime minister can make tough decisions that aren't compromising.
And the president has to combine those two in a way. The president is seen as embodying American values abroad. At the same time, we expect the president to be a tough negotiator. We expect the president to defend American interests abroad, both with their image, but also with their ability to engage in strategy.
I want to get into just a couple other specific characters who have maybe shaped this idea of what is presidential. This is going to seem kind of random, but what about William Howard Taft?
Well, William Howard Taft was an interesting character. We've published books by Lew Gould on Taft and the presidency. He succeeded a president who was a great media character, Theodore Roosevelt, at a time when mass media had developed. Roosevelt, you know, loved the bully pulpit of the White House and to engage with the news media. Taft was a much more reserved character, and in comparison to Roosevelt, seemed kind of dull, frankly, to I think a lot of Americans.
That reputation does not seem to have worn off. I mean, I had to go read about him at whitehouse.gov because I had honestly kind of forgotten what he had done, but I was struck by a few things. First of all, the photographs of this man are amazing. He's got real girth and this dramatic mustache, plus he's kind of like grinning in a bemused way, like he's been told a joke we're not in on, which seems very unpresidential to me. And then what struck me is that whoever's writing the copy for whitehouse.gov doesn't pull any punches when writing about Taft. It starts this way: distinguished jurist, effective administrator, but poor politician. William Howard Taft spent 4 uncomfortable years in the White House. Those are his opening lines of his bio at whitehouse.gov. Poor politician, uncomfortable years in the White House.
Well, I think he saw the presidency as more limited in power than Roosevelt. So he was much more apt to want to, in a sense, follow the rules of the day. He was not did not quite have Roosevelt's ear for politics, and he had the challenge of following somebody who'd been very aggressive and very public about their policy preferences, and who turned into a critic of his. So he ended up having to deal not only with the Democrats, but he had to deal with Republican critics from the progressive wing of the party. And so in some ways, he was in a very challenging situation that probably demanded somebody who was much more assertive in their public advocacy and more sensitive to how to deal with the Republican majorities in Congress.
Can we talk quickly about contrasting experiences with, like, tawdry personal affairs while in office? A study in contrast being Warren G. Harding and Bill Clinton.
Well, one difference between Harding and Clinton is that the media didn't catch on to some of his tawdry political or personal activities.
So, in the case of Harding, clearly.
In Harding. In Clinton's case, this all came out in excruciating detail. The interesting thing about Clinton is that while his, certainly at various times in the impeachment proceedings, his personal approval ratings dropped, his performance ratings continued to be strong. And of course, the impeachment ended up is an unsuccessful effort by Congress. It was, I think, many people perceived Kenneth Starr and his investigations as overreaching.
But do you think, and this applying to Bill Clinton beyond the scandals associated with him, do you think that Bill Clinton changed in any way the idea of what it meant to be presidential? I mean, on the one hand, you have people talking about he's often credited with having a lot of charm. Mm-hmm. He also has an accent that I don't think people were familiar with in that office. I mean, there are a lot of things about him that seemed different.
Well, I mean, by all reports, President Clinton was a or is an extraordinarily engaging personality, and he likes to talk to people. Famously was often never on schedule because he would stop and talk to anyone. And I actually witnessed that on the streets of Princeton one time when he just hopped out of a car where there's a crowd of people to go get a coffee and spent half an hour talking to people on the street. I think that he was forgiven by a lot of Americans for the for his personal transgressions, that there was that the Americans sort of came to the point in which they separated what they thought was a guy with kind of sleazy morals in some areas from somebody who was actually seen as a reasonably effective president. The economy was doing well. The budget was in balance by the end of his administration. He had succeeded in establishing a reputation as an able president.
So it seems like maybe the lesson of Clinton in terms of what is presidential is that there is maybe not that he expanded what that means, but that the American people are willing in some cases to be selective in what attributes of a human being they put in the person's presidential kind of side.
Yes. Yes, I think that is absolutely the case, that Americans are able to distinguish between personal behavior and your professional behavior. It also helps for Clinton that morality generally in the country has become somewhat more accepting of variations from the norm.
And then you mentioned earlier that George W. Bush was associated with being like the guy you would want to have a beer with. And Sarah Vowell, who used to be a frequent commentator on NPR through This American Life, she wrote an interesting piece about the Gore Bush competition as sort of a different version of the jock versus the nerd. And I think that sort of pairs up with this idea of Americans starting to have this idea that the president is someone you'd want to grab a beer with. Can you talk about that? Do you think that this jock versus nerd model is kind of something that reflects what we want in a president?
I think it's something that Americans struggle with. I think that Americans want their president to be somebody they feel they could talk to. I think this is a pervasive theme throughout our history. At the same time, I think they want their president also to be smarter than they are, but not too smart. So presidents like Woodrow Wilson, who came across as arrogant and as people who wouldn't listen, were seen as out of touch with Americans. And the beer thing came up, I believe, during the Kerry Bush election. And at the same time, there were a lot of images of John Kerry engaging in sailing with his sailboat off Cape Cod, and images that projected him as a kind of elite, wealthy man. And so he was seen as out of touch.
That's Chuck Myers, director of the University Press of Kansas in Lawrence, where they publish a series on the American presidency. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll get right back to defining the word presidential when Central Standard returns. But remember, from here on in, history has its eyes on you. This music is from the musical Hamilton. Hello again. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. We're tackling a big idea today, what it means to be presidential, a timely topic in light of presidential primaries and candidates who, in some cases, break a lot of those rules. Our guest is Chuck Myers of the University Press of Kansas. He's edited books about presidents both here and at the Princeton University Press. Chuck, talk to me about media coverage of the president. Has the media historically participated in shaping ideas about not just whoever happens to be in office, but the presidency itself?
Yes, and that's, I think, one of the things that has changed over the history of the republic, beginning in the late 19th century with the growth of media. There became more interest in who the president was as a person and how they acted. And presidents, actually beginning with McKinley, were aware of this and began to take advantage of the media by meeting with reporters, by going out in the country and giving talks in support of their program.
Calling the press together.
Yes, calling the press together in various ways. I mean, the history of press conferences is rather interesting, but it started with a much more informal arrangement. It started with reporters being given space in the White House, actually, and this was
like they keep offices there.
A space where they could work and also the early press conferences had this tradition that presidents were not directly quoted.
Why not?
Because it was thought unseemly somehow for a president to be speaking directly to reporters. So they had this, they would have this go around a White House source would talk about these things. But what the presidents were trying to do was get their message across to the people and to also project this image that they were involved, engaged, and knew what was going on in the government.
When was this and when did it transform? How did it transform?
I think it changed certainly by Franklin Roosevelt, who, of course, used radio. But my guess is in the 20s. I don't know exactly when it started. It changed, but certainly by Franklin Roosevelt, you had a president who regularly met with reporters, liked meeting with reporters, and liked the fact that they could use this as a way to project an image of being in control of what the government was doing. It also happened at a time when the government was engaged in many more activities. So the presidency of George Washington had a much narrower scope than the presidency of Teddy Roosevelt or Woodrow Wilson, so that people were more interested in what the government was doing.
So I guess what I wonder about our ideas about what is presidential is how self-fulfilling is our use of this word, presidential, in an election season? I mean, if all presidential means is befitting the office of the presidency with no specifics in terms of exactly what that entails, then all we're saying when we deem someone presidential or not is that we can either picture this person in the White House or we can't. To me, that's about us.
Right. It to a great extent is about us. I mean, presidents appearing presidential is a political resource for presidents. If a president can successfully convince a majority of the people that they can be presidential, and if elected, they are presidential, that is a resource they can use to persuade leaders and members of Congress, leading the agencies, the populace generally to support their policies. How much that makes a difference is something that is debated in political science widely. You know, how much power that gives them, whether there really is a bully pulpit. But the fact is that presidents try very hard to build an image of competence, of control, that their ideas are the right ideas, and that they're honest, and that they're seeking not their personal gain, but that they're seeking the best for the country. And that's what being presidential really means.
So you think that's the biggest part of establishing yourself as presidential, is that you are someone who wants the best for the country?
Yes, yes. And I think the president, so President Eisenhower came into office with the prestige of having been the leader of the invasion of Europe and a leading general in the war, in the Second World War. And I think people saw him as somehow above personal ambition and able to act in the interest of the country.
How do we expand our concept of who or what is presidential? We've talked about JFK and Barack Obama as people who were sort of firsts in the presidency. And I guess I'm wondering if part of that experience do they have to compensate for being a new face, being something different in the White House by being extra presidential in other ways?
Well, they I think that, as is often the case with minorities and women in almost any job in which you're a first or breaking into, there's a certain pressure to be better, to do the job better than anyone else. It is hard to see that President Obama, if he had the inclinations, would have the same latitude that Bill Clinton had to have somewhat tawdry personal morals. I think Barack Obama is held up to a higher standard. And I think that's true of a minority in almost any job, but particularly the presidency in a situation in which the media is all over him all the time.
In talking about George Washington as the first sort of the first person to really establish even what the president was, let alone how the president appeared, that he thought a lot about how he dressed, how he was addressed, those kinds of things. Do you see someone like Barack Obama paying a lot of attention to those things or making choices in that arena that are significant? Or do you see someone like Hillary Clinton, who hopes to be a first, doing that in her own way?
I think there, to some extent, President Obama and Mrs. Clinton, if she's elected, will already inherit a sort of apparatus of what being president means, as witness "Hail to the Chief" that will be played when they come. But I think they do have to be conscious, and I think President Obama is very conscious of how he speaks, what issues he addresses, how he reaches out to people at times of crisis, the kind of strong image he projects at times of international crisis. And Mrs. Clinton, I think particularly when we are in an international crisis, will have to project an image of being a strong, decisive leader who understands what resources she has at her command to engage with America's enemies, and a sense of strategic smarts. You see presidents, for example, in moments of international crisis, photographed in the Situation Room, often surrounded by their advisors and generals, and this is part of showing a president who is in control of what is going on.
Do you think that being presidential, quote unquote presidential, matters as much in this election as it has in the past?
I actually think it could be very important in this election. I think it will be an issue if Mrs. Clinton is the Democrat candidate for president because of the gender issue, and I think that if the Republicans nominate Mr. Trump, that will be an issue that Democrats will attack him on.
Chuck Myers of the University Press of Kansas, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
The University Press of Kansas publishes an American President series. You can check that out at kansaspress.ku.edu. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll get Reptilian with a guy who studies reptiles in the Dominican Republic. He may be shaking up the way we understand different species. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned.